You can get consolation from all sorts of falsehoods, but because it's consoling, it doesn't mean it's true.
No, there are a lot of very religious scientists around.
Science. There is no evidence for any kind of supernatural being of any kind.
You think people should not have a choice of what to do with their body?
Anti-murdering the unborn.
And I say to the grown-ups, if you want to deny evolution and live in your world that's completely inconsistent with everything we observe in the universe, that's fine. But don't make your kids do it, because we need
But them. Why should I believe? Well, because it's the truth.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to Science, Faith, and Reasoning. We're continuing our belief dialogues. And today we're going to be talking about handling bias, recognizing bias, kind of making sense of the universe, what is your identity, and some other sort of religious views on some of these topics. So to start out, we're just going to let John kind of go off on this first topic. What are some good tools of thought?
Yeah, so there's all kinds of various tools you can use and principles that help you evaluate the world around you, and that in general have shown themselves over time to be more useful for figuring out how the world works or for building things that work, like bridges and buildings and that kind of thing. And I would generally categorize all of these sort of tools into sort of three categories. So you can think of it as constructing models. So that's how do I build sort of a model, a description of the world? And then how do I evaluate between competing models? So say I've got two or three different models that make predictions that all are more or less come true in different ways. How do I pick which model to use and why? And then finally, at what point do you should you discard a model and say, well, this model is kind of like not useful, you know? So that's the general framework, I think, for evaluating all these techniques, right? So when we talk about constructing models, one of the first things I'd talk about is just people will say this, they'll say, look at the facts, right? I kind of extend this though to say, become aware of the wishes you have inside of you, things that you wish were true and not necessarily are, like a fact you wish existed, or it would be nice when this piece of information existed. It would conform with the way you believe versus, do I actually know this? You know? Yeah. And that's very difficult. And I've come up with sort of techniques over time to kind of recognize this in myself so that I can help prevent it. And I think they're pretty useful. One of them is if you turn on, just pick some topic that you're kind of passionate about and that you think a certain way on, and go watch a YouTube video on something that completely disagrees with that, and try to make it through the whole video. And you'll notice if you're on, like, how your body reacts to it. You'll start getting like a bad feeling in your stomach. You'll be like, that's not true. You know, you're wanting to reject the information. You'll think bad, maybe the person presenting it, or they're not doing this. You're hypercritical of how they're presenting the information, right? And all those are physiological processes in your body, which are like reactions to something that is saying, okay, your views might be wrong. And so I think learning to recognize that and learning to actually embrace it is an incredible tool for being able to not only just like understand different perspectives, but actually sort of figure out how the world actually works. Because if you go through the world, just imagine you, like your two eyes, you're only getting your biased selection and perspective and view of the world. But if you can get yourself to actually see from the eyes of other people, you know, it's like seeing an object in three dimensions. If all you can ever see is the one photograph, you might not understand that the other side is like blue or red or different colors, or there's a forest, you know? And if you can get around that object to see it in three dimensions, you can get a better perspective for what it is.
Yeah.
One of the techniques is engaging in that wishful thinking. You also notice it when someone says something that you agree with, you're much less likely to say, where do you know that? Or are you sure about that? Where are you getting this information from?
Yeah.
Whereas if someone tells you something you disagree with, most people be like, well, I've heard this, or I've read this other thing that contradicts that, which is what they already believe.
Exactly.
And that's that process showing itself.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, because I recently ran into this issue with, I was wanting to write an article for a long time, and like, I really want to dive into what the Bible says about wine and alcohol.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, I'm going into this, you know, praying about, like, I want to be honest, just what does the Bible say about this topic? And, you know, my preconception was there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah.
Because that's what I've heard and that's what I wanted to believe, you know.
Yeah.
And then getting into it, I realized there were a lot of things about it that I hadn't really thought about.
Yeah.
At least not deeply.
For instance, what?
So, for example, really kind of the crux or the center point of the whole discussion comes back to this passage in Romans 14 where it talks about no matter what I do, I shouldn't do things, even if they're completely okay, in front of people, that it's going to harm those people. So like, there's nothing wrong with having a beer or having a glass of wine.
Yeah.
But if you're with someone who's an alcoholic, now you're making your brother stumble into alcoholism. Maybe they've been clean for a few weeks and now they're back into it.
Yeah.
So it's really like there's nothing inherently wrong with the substance, but the way we use it, we can abuse it, and the context in which it's consumed, you're a reflection of Christianity and you're a reflection of Christ. And there were so many contextual aspects to it that I had not anticipated.
Yeah.
Some of them I was kind of familiar with. Some of them I was like, wow, I never really thought about that way.
Well,
and anyway, go ahead.
I just want to interject real quick. Like, even that example you gave, I could imagine different people. So, for instance, say you're an alcoholic. Some alcoholics will, like, quit cold turkey, and, like, no alcohol is going to tempt them ever again.
Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, I imagine around that type of person, so if you knew them, like, drinking around them wouldn't be a stumbling block or anything because it's, like, it's not even an issue. You know? It's like some people who quit smoking and then never smoke a cigarette another day in their life because they're done with it.
Exactly.
You know? Versus people who are, like, quit, but they're always, you know, it's like, oh, I need another cigarette. And then like 2 years later, they're smoking again and then they quit, you know, that type of person who, if they're around people that smoke, then they're going to be much more likely, you know?
Right.
So even in that, like, one little example, I feel like context would matter.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And then just sending it to people that I trust to review it. And I sent it to a bunch of people before I published it or told people about it.
Yeah.
And you could just kind of get a feel for the things in the article that they had problems with. A lot of them were legitimate concerns, and I made mistakes. And I had to correct them and things. But other things, it's like you could tell where they wanted it to be.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was the same way. Like, when I wrote it, there was a certain way I wanted it to be, and it ended up being a lot more moderate than I thought it was going to end up being.
Yeah.
So just this week, I've kind of ran into that situation.
You run into that all over the place. You run into that. Another big example is in the corporate world, where you're collecting data on some metric where people's, like, bonuses and salaries are defined on that metric, and you present them with the data, and it's like, okay, you're not going to get your bonus. And then it's like, that can't be true. You know, like, they will not accept that. You know, it has to be the case. Like, how can I fudge these numbers such that I get my bonus, right?
Do y'all have that at you?
And it might not be, like, even explicit knowledge that they're acknowledging that. It's just, you know, subconsciously, like, no, this cannot be the case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At your work, do y'all have that kind of system? Like, if we get this, we get a bonus at Christmas?
In my particular job, in my department, we don't. But yeah, I've definitely seen it. Yeah.
I bet people go pretty crazy over that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Not even when it's bonuses, just when it's simple things like you're evaluated on how many of X you, let's just say, you do per week. You know, like, you might actually do 20 per week. But when you're evaluated on that and your boss is coming in saying, you know, they're saying you're a good or bad worker based on this one metric, then you're going to count other things towards that or want to see things that boost that.
Right.
Versus, like, kind of viewing what's actually going on. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's going to give you that sort of wishful thinking again, too, when you're presented with other information. And so that's why you might be in a meeting. Someone's, like, angry or reacting negatively about something. And it's because of that same thing.
Yeah,
that sort of, like, I know I need it to be this way, and they might not even be cognizantly aware of that. Yeah.
So, what would your advice be for Christians who are running into their bias, obviously, like, evolution or topics like that?
The way I've found, what they believe. Yeah, I don't know if this is specific for Christians, but, like, for me personally, the way I found to best get by sort of what's in your gut is to, number one, learn to actively embrace it. So, if I find someone who's telling me things that I already agree with, that's fine. I'll watch some of it. But I actively seek out things that disagree with me. And that's a process that's not natural. So the natural process is to have an idea. For instance, with your example with drinking in the Bible. You think it's wrong, let's say. Like, you should never drink, whatever. So you go online and you look up why the Bible says you should never drink. And you find people who say that, and you feel happy.
Right.
So my advice would be do the opposite. Do the thing that makes you feel bad. Why the Bible says you should drink and it is okay to drink. Right. And then read those articles. And don't read them. And here's the thing. If you read them saying, how are all the ways I can reject this? It's still not going to help you.
Right.
You have to read them saying, okay, I am one of these people. Like, you have to take on the identity to some extent of someone who believes that.
Right.
And if you can't, you'll never understand. Number one, just understand. You won't understand exactly where another person's coming from. So that would be my advice in people to general. Like, the way you search out information to change that, and then to actively not try to reject it, but try to embrace it and understand it.
Yeah.
Like, become one of them. Say, okay, now I am someone who believes that drinking is okay in the Bible. And I'm reading this thinking in that way.
Yeah. I think it gives you some perspective and humility to when you discuss that topic with somebody. Because you put yourself in their shoes and you can kind of better understand. Yeah. And then also, if you want to be able to destroy that framework, if you don't understand where they're coming from, you don't really understand their position. Therefore, you're just going to be talking past each other, not really getting anywhere.
Exactly. You will be saying things that won't make any sense to them.
Right.
Because you'll be looking at it through your lens and it's not their lens, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was just the first part. So this goes, there's like different tools I have here.
Okay.
That was just like wishful thinking and kind of going against your gut feeling and then how you search for information. Another thing I would say that's very useful when it comes to constructing models and figuring out good models for describing the world and understanding reality is become an active mistake maker. So what is that? What do I mean by that? What I mean is take these things and try them out. So if you believe something, the best way to figure out whether or not it works is to try to apply it. You know, like, I mean, the easiest things for this are like physics and mathematics, right? Because, I mean, mathematics is probably even easier than physics because you can just take some theorem, some axioms, apply it to a problem and see whether or not it works. In computer science, I do that. It's also easy because then you can say, okay, so given this idea in computer science, can I build, for instance, a chatbot? Does this technique work? And you try to build it and you see if it works. Does it work like a chatbot when I write something? Does it sound like a human when it responds? You know, and maybe the technique works. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it just sounds like it's repeating the same three words every time. And you're like, well, this technique clearly doesn't work because I tried to build it. And so I would say try to experiment with things, and also like tools for like not only just ideas about the world or theories, but like actual things people tell you to do. So if it's like be kind to your neighbor or be humble or those types of things, like apply them and then think about how it actually worked. You know, like try to evaluate it.
Yeah.
Whether or not, is that a good tool? You know, like when you get angry with someone or when you yell at somebody, is that a good way to get what you want? You know?
Yeah.
Is it? Is it not? Maybe sometimes it is. But what are the situations where you do need that? And what are the situations where you don't? You know? So like poke at the world with these theories and ideas and it'll poke back and it'll tell you whether or not they work or don't. Mm. So that's sort of the second point, I guess. And then the final thing I would say is be the most critical for your own beliefs. So what you believe now, like always be looking at the errors and mistakes. So like if I have a model right now that builds a chatbot, right? I want to try to find all the errors in this chatbot before I go look at other people's chatbots and criticize them, you know? So that's same thing with all your own beliefs and things that you accept.
That's kind of like, reminds me of the verse, you know, before you can help your brother, before you can take the speck out of your brother's eye, remove the log in your own.
Yeah.
It's like you have probably bigger problems than this person has, especially in that area that you're talking about with that person, like maybe alcoholism. Mm. It's like, are you an alcoholic? Yeah. Probably not the best person to give advice to. But well, if you're an ex-alcoholic, you probably are the best person to give the advice to. Yeah. But just when you're saying that, that reminded me of that verse.
Well, that reminds me of another thing. For why this approach is so good is that it's much easier to it's hard to change like errors in your own thinking, but it's much easier than it is to change errors in someone else's thinking. You know, like if I can finally recognize my own errors, then at least I can start, you know, doing little tests and techniques to try to correct them for myself, like immediately. Like I don't have to wait for someone else to agree, like convince them, hey, this is a thinking flaw or whatever. You should probably try to work on it, you know?
Do you know the psychology of recognizing problems in other people and that being a reflection of the problems that you don't realize you actually have? Is there any psychology to that, or do you know anything about that?
No, I don't actually.
Okay.
That's the topic I haven't looked into in psychology. I've looked into biases in psychology, but not. There's this great book by Kahneman, and it's called Thinking. I think it's called Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. And in that whole book, he goes through a host. He's a psychologist, and he and I think a research colleague go through just pretty much every thinking bias humans have. And they research, he spent his whole life researching it. And he wrote a whole book on it that I read years ago. And it is. It's, I would suggest anyone read that just to understand all the biases we have, because there are a ton. You know, it's not like one little bias, confirmation bias, which maybe if you've ever looked into biases, you've heard of. That's just like actively searching out things that agree with you, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's selection bias, all kinds of other biases.
Yeah. So we had talked before we started filming about, you'd mentioned like scientific papers.
Yeah.
So how does that tie into?
Oh, well, just... when you have anything, like I gave an example with the corporate world where people are measured by this, of what they wish to be. And the same thing is true of sort of like if you're a researcher and you've spent your whole career, say, on some theory, right? Then you're hyper, how can I describe it? Anytime you do research, you're, that is what this theory is, what's giving you your career, your notoriety, your status in the world, right?
Yeah.
So you're heavily biased to want it to be true, to try to conduct your research in such a way that it should be shown to be true, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And there have been plenty of cases, like if you look at the history of science, where tons of researchers have like covered up things or fudged the data in certain ways so that their research continued to be true. And that's why when I look at papers, or like a topic, and I see there's only like one researcher, maybe two in a field, like very, very few, and they're the only ones talking about it, it makes me hyper skeptical of the validity of that research.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there's not other views or perspectives that are criticizing them. You know, they're just like running on their own. And that's very dangerous. You know, even if you're aware, even if you're a well-meaning scientist, and you're kind of aware of the biases in the first place, it's just something that's naturally part of our biology, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Do you have anything else you wanted to, final thoughts on bias, or
move on? There's a lot more to say on this topic, and I would just encourage anyone to definitely read that book by Kahneman, and maybe look up...
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, and maybe look up all the links on like cognitive biases on Wikipedia or something, because... there's a lot, and I think there's a lot to be learned about people if you start, you know, reading about these different biases. And you'll learn about yourself, too. You'll notice them about yourself, yeah.
What are some areas where you wanted something to be the case, like a research paper you're reading, or you're looking for an answer to something, and you're like, dang, I got to step back for a second and, like, analyze my bias, like, where you saw that affecting you in a conclusion you might have?
Well, there's certainly during my master's research. Now, I don't know if this really lines up to it, but there was a paper that I found where the technique would have been really easy to implement. And so I really wanted that paper to be true.
Yeah.
You know, because it was one of those things where it was like, oh man, this would make, I wouldn't have to do a lot of work if this really works, you know?
Yeah.
And I implemented the paper and probably spent too much time trying to implement it. And
was it a bad technique?
It turned out to not be a good technique. And I think probably the paper was made up, or because I couldn't reproduce the data. And I asked my professor about this and he said, yeah, unfortunately you find that a lot.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So I guess these papers pass because the peer review people maybe haven't done it.
Like probably don't try to implement it. Like they'd read the paper, see the data, and think, okay, well, this all checks out, you know? But when you go to actually try to build it, that's when you realize. That gets back to my point of don't just, you know, if you can, try to build these things and test them in the world. And they'll tell you whether or not it works or not.
So when you had done that,
is
there an obligation to like contact these people?
I tried to contact them because I thought maybe, you know, I'm implementing it wrong.
And what did they say?
They didn't respond.
They're probably like, uh-oh. They're all to us. Wow, that is incredible. Okay. Yeah. So the next topic we want to talk about was identity.
Mm-hmm.
So like, what is our identity and what do we think about the concept of identity?
Yeah. So identity is an interesting one because I've been thinking about this in the context mainly of bias. But so I think identity can be one of those things that heavily biases you. I mean, we know this from a lot of research where, you know, they'll take just random people and then put them into two groups, group A and group B. And within a couple minutes, they start identifying with group A. I'm group A and that's group B, you know?
Yeah.
And they'll say, you know, we can either give you, and they've done studies like, okay, group A, you can either get $5 and group B will get $5, right? Or you can get, what was it? You can get a dollar and group B will get nothing. And they'll take the dollar where group B gets nothing.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's things like that that very quickly you can start to see how identity, when you start identifying with a group or anything in particular, how that will make you sort of not only have negative feelings towards what you perceive to be the out group, but also bias the way you think. And
wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. So after reading some of that research, I started thinking, you know, a lot of our identity is something that you shouldn't be so attached to. Like you, And so you shouldn't say, oh, I'm a, you know, white man, and that's what I identify as. Like me personally, that's what I don't think viewing yourself in that way is helpful, you know?
Yeah.
Because then you're going to see people that aren't white men as not being part of your group.
Yeah.
And that's going to start shifting and biasing your thinking.
So do you feel like, I mean, a lot of modern politics is like, we're for the blue collar people.
Yes.
We're for the rich, educated people. Like, so how do you feel about identity politics? And yes, do you feel like that is a problem or I guess so based on?
Yeah, I think, yeah, I think it certainly biases your thinking, but again, it's a way to motivate people. It's a way to get them to be, to feel antagonistic towards another group. And that leads to engagement, right? So,
So
psychologically it clearly works, but whether or not that brings out our own better natures, I'm highly skeptical of.
Yeah.
You know, so if we want to be better human beings and kinder towards other people, I don't think having these strong identities is useful. That doesn't mean you can't enjoy them, you know? That doesn't mean you can't say, oh, okay, well, I like being a man, you know? But it also, I think you should also say, you know, how can I describe it? Like, it's not that you're defining yourself through that thing, you know? Because then it makes it difficult for you to also understand other identities and empathize with their views.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's one of the powerful things about Jesus's earthly ministry was that he went to an identity that was the outcast.
Mm.
And the upper echelon of the religious sect was,
yeah,
they didn't like that he was engaging with those people.
Mm.
Because, like, they're not, like, these are the lowest of the low, and you're hanging out with them. And it created, and the identity back then was huge. Mm. I guess it's similar to today, you know, if you were a Gentile or Samaritan.
Yeah.
And Jews, like, that was such a, well, this is my tribe,
yes,
that's your tribe, I hate you.
Exactly.
You know?
That's what ends up happening, you know? It's like, I'm a Jew versus, or they're Muslims, I'm not a Muslim, you know? They're different, and then it's very easy to fall, and you see this throughout history, it's very easy to fall in that line of thinking, well, my group is good, therefore they're evil. That group that's not good, you know?
Yeah.
The foreign, the other.
And I think Christianity has been abused, like, big time to create a separation of us and them.
Yeah.
But I think from my reading of it, I think it's a beautiful way to bridge gaps, even though historically and today people use it to burn bridges.
Yeah.
I think just if you look at Jesus's life and not what people have made things out to be, I think it's a good bridge builder, especially just like looking at how we engage with all these people who were the outcasts and the downtrodden. Yeah. And I think it's a good model for us to be like, who cares who I'm associated with?
Yes.
Like, that's not what it's about.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think that's kind of interesting.
Mm. No, I think it's interesting you say that about religion, because religion very much does, I mean, not picking any religion, like, most religions kind of do the same thing. It becomes the in-group versus the out-group, you know, my tribe versus your tribe, as you said. And I think for me, it's not that you reject that, because you really can't go through life without any identity. Society puts identities on you, whether you like them or not.
Yeah.
You know, other people will tell you you're white, you know?
Yeah.
Regardless of whether or not maybe you had a black ancestor, you know? Mm-hmm. They'll just look at you and tell you what you are. And so to a certain extent, you have to deal with them. But I think strongly embracing them is where the danger is, you know? And when you get to talk, when you start talking about bridges, I think it's where if you can live in such a way where you say, okay, well, maybe this is what I am. You know, I'm a Christian or Buddhist or whatever you are. But these other things are also okay identities to have, you know?
Yeah.
I think, and perhaps, you know, I could have them. And that's the thing where I think most people can't. They can't do and they can't deal with. They think, you know, well, that's just wrong. That's just not it.
Right.
You know? And then they start, then it builds that, those gaps.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was a point where, that I got to with Christianity where I was, obviously I'm a conservative, so it's like low taxes, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But that's not my ultimate identity. Mm-hmm. Like I put way too much stock in politics instead of Christ as example.
Yeah.
And I think that was a big, just I guess stumbling block in my life, like a big mistake that I've made is trying to make those kinds of things the most important thing.
Yeah.
That's not.
Yeah.
And I feel like it really gets you into warped thinking.
Yeah. Well, that's what we're talking about, the biases. It certainly does. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I guess from your perspective, the Christ-centered focus would be warped thinking as well.
Yes, but here's the thing. If like, I don't know how to articulate this, but it's not a evil thing. Or I don't hate people that are Christians or have anything against them, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not judging them for what they believe, right? And I think if you can do that for other groups, it'll help you a lot. Like I've actively embraced that perspective. Yeah. So like those goggles, and I understand what it means to believe that and to think those things.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm not sitting here saying, you know, nut job, warped, crazy person.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Okay. I feel like a lot of this really has a lot of applications to Christianity, actually. I did not think that when we first started this conversation, but now I'm starting to see some things. You had mentioned before we started filming about setting yourself up for disappointment with regards to identity.
Yeah.
So what do you mean by that exactly?
Setting up yourself for disappointment. Well, this gets to a concept that's like one of the central concepts of Buddhism, and that is attachment. So there's many different ideas in Buddhism, but one of them is that everything has a beginning, like the universe or whatever, a tree, you know, at some point it's a seed falling down into the ground, and then it's there for a while, you know, it grows into a tree and then it blossoms, and at some point, you know, it dies, it gets struck by lightning or just gets old or a tornado storm comes and the tree falls down and it dies. And so there's this idea of impermanence, that everything has its essentially has a coming into being, is there for a while, and then has a going out of being, is there no more, right? And so the idea is that when you are attached to things, so I need my car, I need this relationship, I need an attachment to identity, I'm an athlete, I'm a strong man, right? All those things are impermanent. So all of them, they come into being, you know, you're a little boy, then you become a strong man, and you're a strong man for a while, then you're old, you're weak, and you die, right? And so there's a sadness that people get with that, right? But that is the way life is. And so you need to embrace it. And if you become too attached to that, then that's where suffering arises. And suffering, the understanding of suffering is one of the main idea of Buddhism. So when they're looking at all these different things, attachment in this case, and the impermanence of everything, that's what they're trying to understand, is how does suffering arise in the world? And so another idea with this impermanence and attachment is to learn what they call non-attachment. But it's basically that you recognize the impermanence of all things and that you learn to appreciate the moment. Like we're talking right now, you know, to appreciate that moment that we have that will soon be over and the podcast will be done, right? So you live in this moment, you appreciate it, you value it, and then it's gone, and it will never be again. So that's kind of this idea of impermanence and non-attachment from Buddhism. Yeah.
Okay. And how would that tie into setting yourself up for disappointment, do you think?
Well, I mean, clearly, I think, you know, if you identify, whatever, to give me an identity. You identify as, or you are attached to your car, right? And your car is broke. Well, now you're sad. Your car is broke. You don't have your car, right? Mm-hmm. That's like part of what's defining you. Or you're attached to money. Then you become bankrupt. Now you're poor. Well, now you're distraught and you're stressed, right?
So you're saying like recognizing the temporal nature of these things helps you appreciate them in the moment and then understand when they're gone.
And already accept they will be gone. There will be a time when they're no more, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's very wise.
It's been one of the most useful tools for me, you know, in life is that those few concepts. Because, you know, I've been very sick and things that I've had have, you know, I've become weak, I've become frail, I've spent much time in a hospital. I've had to accept the, face that thing that very few, you know, most people face towards the end of their life, but everyone will face at some point, and that's that you will die, and it is over. And most people can think about that, but until it actually, you're there and you see it, it's not the same, you know? Because I meditated on death before that. I mean, one of the ideas of, again, Buddhism is this impermanence. You meditate on death. You try to accept it and everything. That's not the same as when it's there.
Right.
Right. So, but this is why I think this idea of really accepting impermanence and learning to embrace it, but and learning this idea of non-attachment. So appreciating the things that are there, but not being so attached to them that you need them to define you, that you need them to make you happy, that you need them to fulfill you, because that is setting yourself up for sorrow and despair.
Yeah.
Yeah. And disappointment.
Right. So do you feel that the meditation technique, so is Buddhism have the meditation technique? Is that a part of it?
So Buddhism, this is a very interesting thing. So it's very different from most of the Abrahamic religions, right? So there's supposedly, there was this Buddha guy who said all these things. But
you think he didn't, maybe he didn't
You know, live? Maybe he didn't exist, who knows? But what happened was these monks got these ideas from ostensibly the Buddha, and they started like repeating his sayings for years and years and years and generations and hundreds of years. And over time, different schools of thought emerged. So you get a Buddhist monk that would go down to southern India, and they would start a school, and that school would begin teaching things. And then you'd have, you know, a Buddhist monk go into China, and then that would sort of mix with the Chinese society, and they would write things down. And in China, they had Taoism and Confucianism and these other sort of religions that would mix with it. And then you had Buddhist monks that would go to Japan, and then they would mix with sort of the Shintoism and the different religions of Japan. And so they had their own sort of variety of Buddhism there. And this is all like starting from 500 BC and going onwards, I think, somewhere around that time. And so you have a lot of different varieties and tons of different texts. So there is no like Bible or canonical text.
Not like a primary text.
Yeah, like where you say, okay, this is all the teachings of the Buddha. Right?
Okay, wow.
There's just different writings, and then you glean from them sort of different insights.
Okay. You know?
And so there's now.
So what do you buy then? Like if you want to study Buddhism, what is, do you buy like a collection of those writings? And what would that be called?
There's a Vietnamese, probably the best person I've found to be able to condense ideas of Buddhism. And on the podcast, we could put this on the screen, right?
Yeah, we can.
I don't know how to pronounce this guy's name. I'll show it him to you later. But he's from Vietnam, and he survived the Vietnam War. And then he opened up sort of a monastery, I think in France, later in his life. And then he wrote a bunch of books about Buddhism. He was a Buddhist monk. And his books are like, well, they'll take certain like peace or compassion, like these ideas from Buddhism, and they'll break it down. And they'll break down like the various, I think there's one book, Being Peace by him, that's a really good book. And he sort of condenses a lot of these texts. Because, I mean, we're talking a massive text, like just way bigger than the Torah plus New Testament plus all the other writings.
Wow, yeah. That's a lot.
And he'll condense, he'll condense a lot of the ideas. But there is sort of, there are a couple texts that I would say are kind of like major texts. So the Dhammapada is one of them. And that's probably the biggest, I would say, if you were to pick one text, that's probably one of the major, biggest ones that sort of, I think, most of the schools share.
Is that the name of a person?
This is the name of the collection of texts.
Okay.
Yeah. Or like, yeah.
I was gonna say, oh yeah, so with meditation.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So getting to that point on meditation. So as far as I know, like certainly Zen Buddhism has meditative practice. I think and then sort of Buddhism mixed with Hindu traditions that have meditation in them, as far as I know. I haven't practiced meditation really.
Okay. I thought you had.
No. So I don't know too much about it, to be honest, like what all the traditions do. And I will say too, there's sort of also the Western interpretation of a lot of these Buddhist texts, which is very sort of practical and secular in nature. And then there's sort of the traditional sort of interpretation of the Buddhist texts, which can be very, I guess, you know, religious in the sense that there's a belief in deities and gods and all these types of things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is the Dalai Lama?
What is he?
Yeah. What is that exactly? Is that like their high priest or something?
That, you know, honestly, I think that's in Tibetan Buddhism, if I'm correct.
Okay.
And he's, you know, they have the belief in reincarnation. And so he's selected every generation after the Buddha dies, sort of the next reincarnation.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. So I guess with reincarnation as a quick side point, do you think, because from a naturalistic perspective, material wise, we are recycled.
Yes.
You know, as far as the at the atomic and energy level.
Yeah.
So does that resonate with you at all, the idea of reincarnation? And what do you think about that from a naturalistic worldview?
Reincarnation is interesting in one way. Remember we were talking about the researchers, like this idea of research bias, and if there's only one researcher in a field, you're highly skeptical of it, right?
Right.
So there is this university, I think it's the University of Virginia, if I'm not mistaken, and they have a department called the Department of Noetic Studies, I think. Don't ask me what noetic means. But there's a couple researchers there that have studied the past lives of children. So
past lives.
Yeah, children who believe they're like 2 or 3 or 4 years old, and they believe they were someone else in a past life. Like one of the stories I think that they tell is this little kid who just started drawing planes that were blowing up in fire as a little kid. And he would have, like, I think nightmares and stuff like that. And he said he was this pilot and that he went down in a particular type of plane and all this stuff. And they're like, how does he know this? And, like, why is he saying this, you know? And so his dad went to, like, say, look, what is all this nonsense? And so he went to look up, like, what he was talking about. And he found that there was a pilot that went down in this plane that, you know, crashed and burned and all this other stuff. And so there's, I think at this point, like 2,000 or something odd children. And they've done research on it where they remember past lives. So they remember being a different person in a past life. They talk about it. And these are ones that could not have, how can I describe it, known about anything in that past life. And it'll be like different time periods, different sexes, different continents, right? Now, the reason I'm highly skeptical of this, because it is research and they're documenting all this and they're looking into it. And it's the one thing, it's the only thing I've ever seen that made me think, huh, that's interesting. And that's a lot of things that the way science is it's like, it's not conforming to any particular belief. It's just like a weird piece of data and you don't know what to do with it.
Yeah. So what do you think is happening with those kids?
Well, I think the most likely is that it's just random. It's just like, it's just some random phenomena that, like, statistically, if you had a billion people,
you're going to get it.
You're going to get something like this. That's one thing. Another thing is there's just bias in the researchers and they're polluting the data somehow. So they're like talking to the kids or they want it to be true in some way. So that would be like the second most probable, you know? So there's those sorts of things. And then you get to, so that, but it, what it did do is it did increase my belief that, okay, there could be some type of consciousness that is going on.
Yeah.
You know, because clearly these kids are not those other people in the sense that they also have their own lives and their own identities and their own thoughts.
And I'm guessing in these research papers, they have like some very specific things. Mm. Because if I said in a past life, I was a pilot that crash landed.
Yeah.
Well, no matter what I say in that sentence, somebody before me at some point would fit the mold of that. You know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
I was a knight in the Middle Ages. Like, all right, you're going to find somebody that got his head cut off or whatever the experience was, you know?
Yes.
So, like, how do they?
Well, these lectures are on YouTube. So anyone can look them up and watch them. And they do say that. They say these are the criteria by which we're filtering these guys out.
Wow, like, that's interesting.
Yeah, so for instance, if it were possible for them to have found out about the information through the internet or whatever, like, those aren't counted, I'm pretty sure. So it's things like that that they do. Yeah.
That's really weird.
Yes.
That is really weird.
It's one of the things I've seen, which is like, huh. Because, makes me wonder, you know?
Yeah.
And there's also another guy who, this is a completely different topic and takes us way too far off topic. But he explores like this idea of not the universe first, but consciousness first. And he's created this theory of, conscious agents that communicate with one another. And if you assume one thing, and that's sort of the an evolutionary process that is mathematical and agents that interact, then he's made some interesting proofs. Like, he's proved that you will never see reality for what it is, just like we don't. You know, we don't see the atomic structure of reality. We see approximations that our mind constructs for reality. Like this cup, we don't see it as a, you know, ton of molecules like interacting in the airflow in the room and all this stuff. Like, we ignore all that. And for instance, another example would be light. We only see a very small portion of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Right.
But there's a massive portion there.
Yeah, I've really wondered about that. If you could see the other radio waves or like X-rays, if we could see those, or UV radiation,
yeah,
would those be different colors off the spectrum that we have?
Yeah.
Like, what would that be exactly?
You can't imagine. It's like imagining five dimensions.
Yeah.
You can't comprehend.
But it has to be there, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's there. I mean, it's there. It's really just the continuation of a wave. It's really just an alternate waveform. So it would be interesting. There's different sort of ways, like infrared. Like, we map that into our own, like, limited perspective of reality. You know, we take these, what would that be in this case? Like, higher heat temperatures, which would be like higher frequency, I think. Yeah, it would be a higher frequency temperature of light, and we map it down into the spectrum that we can see as red.
With some kind of apparatus we've designed. I wonder if we could ever augment our brain with some type of device that would then present to us colors that we can't imagine.
You would have to have a device. Well, you'd have to have a device sensor. It would be interesting if you had a sensor that could somehow pick up those signals. And then you map that into neurons, because right now our sensors only pick up those wavelengths, electrum EM spectrum. So if you could somehow create a sensor that picked up more links and just map that into your neurons, that would be
well. I guess Elon's on the case.
Yeah, he's trying to do it.
He'll pull it off.